are going to pop up soon. But the first is, take your time, no worries, is to describe the injury problem in national parks. The second is to provide an overview with some examples of what parks are doing about visitor injury. And finally, I'm going to talk to you a little bit about the future direction of this program, what I hope to do, what I hope to accomplish. So before I plunge on, and I guess I just hit... That's what I'm doing. Let me give you a little background on the Park Service. The Park Service was established 90 years ago, and it was established for the purpose of preserving the natural treasures in our country, from seashores to monuments to cultural sites to what you might commonly know as the Grand Canyon, our first park, Yellowstone. There are 392 parks in total, covering 84 million acres throughout the United States. In every state, actually, except Delaware. Not sure why, poor Delaware. But on average, there are approximately 275 million people that visit national parks every year. And this is a chart that really just shows the number of visitors, so it's not that important that you see the bottom, although if you can, it's 1970 through 2005. What you can see is there's been some growth in terms of visitation, but not as much growth as you'd expect, perhaps, and in fact, it's declined a little bit recently. The trend line is the number of units that we've established. So we started with fewer units and now have 392. So the number of units has grown while the visitation has not grown so much. The National Park Service really is a world leader in responding to injuries and to responding to emergencies through both our search and rescue program and our emergency services program. And these efforts are consistent with the park mission, one of our park policies, which is clearly identifies that saving a human life and prevention of injuries is a principal priority in the parks. What I hope this new program will do is to assist parks to reinforce their prevention efforts. So now the question is, are injuries a problem in the parks? Well, we know there have been fatalities in our parks, and in fact, enough fatalities to fill pages of a few books. What's critical to understand about national parks is that they're not risk-free, and they're really not meant to be. So in order to scope the problem, I explored the following questions. I looked at unintentional serious visitor injuries and fatalities in 2005 and 2006. I looked at fatally injured visitors between 2001, when I got there, literally days after I got there, and September 30th, 2007, by looking at activity they were undergoing, engaged in, the cause, and demographics. And then I'm going to talk a little bit about our search and rescue program, and specifically in 2006. Currently, the National Park Service does not have a service-wide surveillance program or system to collect data on injuries. So I had to rely on currently available data. And so I relied on these sources of information. The first source of information, the Performance Management Data System, is actually a government requirement. It's part of a GPRA goal, which is the Government Performance Result Act, in which parks are required to submit at the end of the year the number of serious visitor events that have occurred and the number of serious the number of fatalities that have occurred. So that's what I have available to me. And they started that in 2005. And I'll talk a little bit about the other data that I had available. What I should say is that these data systems have varying levels of strength and weaknesses, but I'll talk about that too. So we'll first review the data from the Performance Management Data System. And this system showed us that there were an average of 5,100 serious injury events per year. And I say events because it's not injury. For example, if there's a car crash with four individuals who are all seriously injured, it'd count as one. So it's not person. It's not individual data. And then on average, 150 people are killed in the parks every year. And what I should underscore is these, again, are unintentional injuries. So I didn't count homicides, suicides, or even a death related to some pre-existing condition of that visitor. If they came in and had, you know, if they had diabetes or a heart condition, that would not be included in that. To look at it another way, on average, a visitor dies in our park system every 2.5 days. And an average of 15 people are seriously injured in the parks every day. Also, the data from the PMDS indicate that most injuries, about 90%, and even up to 95%, are reported in about 50 of our parks. Well, that's helpful for me to target our efforts, to know that those both the injuries and fatalities are really concentrated in 50 to 60 of our parks. What I have here is, and you won't be able to even know what those acronyms is, because when I came, I had no idea what they were, but they're actually the names of some of our parks. The first two you can see, Yosemite and GW Parkway. But these are 23 parks that, the parks that reported 50 or more injuries. And you'll see this huge jump in Yosemite, and that may be for a variety of reasons. One thing is they do have a lot of injuries at Yosemite for a lot of reasons, and GW Parkway is a park right here. And they have, as you can imagine, a lot of motor vehicle crash and other incidents that occur in the park. So this just gives you an idea of sort of the range of the different kind of reporting that happens in terms of the PMDS. I also looked at the morning report. The morning report is a report that the rangers provide on a daily basis, the chief ranger would provide on a daily basis to the national office that would be a level one, they call her two, incident. And a fatality would be that sort of incident. They would also report on a serious injury, but this data would not capture that really well because they oftentimes don't collect serious injuries. So I was able, at minimum, to, beginning when I got there in January, to start collect data on the fatalities. I also collect injuries, but it's because it doesn't grasp all of them, I really focused on fatalities. So what I found so far between the 1st of January and September 30th was that there were 112 unintentional fatalities in our parks. And of those, 27, or about 24%, were motor vehicle fatalities, and the rest were recreational fatalities. What you can see from the data is that most were male, 78%, and the range of age was, you know, the age range from about 5 to 80, the median age being about 38. I also looked at the day in terms of the activity that the person was doing when they were fatally injured. And driving was the main activity, followed by walking and hiking and then swimming. And I actually separated climbing and hiking to distinguish between technical climbing, where you'd use, you know, serious equipment and be a serious experienced hiker, between those who just go and walk and hike. And then in terms of causes, drowning was the leading cause of death during the reporting period, followed by falls and motor vehicle crashes. That would be because not only if you looked at the previous slide, you would have seen, and perhaps we can do that, I don't know, but let me guess, things like boating, canoeing, water sports, diving, swimming would all contribute to drownings, as well as walking. There are many people who walk across creeks and then die. So when I looked at the fatality trend from January through September, what you can see is during the summer months, and perhaps even a little peak in the spring, we'll get more fatalities than we would at other times. So I also want to describe some of our data from our search and rescue because of the importance of this program. And in 2006, our park EMS service responded to about 25,000 incidents. About 10% of those required advanced life support. They reported nearly 300 fatalities. And this represents fatalities both from unintentional injuries and even suicide and homicide. That's why it would be higher than the ones I reported, the 150 I reported earlier. Our search and rescue teams throughout the Park Service respond to more than 3,600 incidents a year, and this is not inconsistent. If you look at previous data, this is about where they have responded, about 3,600. And through these efforts, the SAR teams were able to save more than about 1,000 people. Of course, not all the fatalities in our parks would have required a SAR, so that explains why the number of fatalities, 119, would be, again, lower than the ones I reported earlier from the PMDS. So sort of internal validities on some of these data that I'm looking at. Some of the causes of SAR: hiking, swimming, boating, rock climbing, things you probably wouldn't be surprised to hear about. And then SAR locations, mostly beach and waterfront areas, not surprising given the drowning problem, and high elevation were another reason. It's just a slide here that shows that our own staff are put at great peril and risk, and often tragic results from having to search and rescue for visitors. There are limitations in these data because it's not a surveillance system and it wasn't set up that way. So there are probably more than I've even thought of here, but they may underreport if injuries not documented by the park. Many injuries occur, people leave. If they broke a leg even, they may go to a hospital. We would never even know about that. Some parks provide much more thorough reports, like Yosemite actually goes to their clinic and they collect the data. That's why perhaps that number's so high, artificially high, or others are artificially low. Parks may define serious differently. So that's a critical difference in terms of how they may report it. They don't have an adequate data collection system, as I've mentioned, and they have even different data collection systems in place that aren't linked to each other. So I have a lot of work to do. So the question is, what is the National Park Service doing about visitor problems? While closing down access to dangerous parts of the parks, or building guardrails, for example, over, you know, high cliffs and perimeters of high cliffs may be a solution to preventing injuries in the parks, these are not always an option for the Park Service. In fact, these kinds of approaches may conflict with the mission of the park. But sometimes it's done. For example, in Olympic National Park, which is right here, after a 26-year-old girl jumped from this first rock here, and it was actually low rain season, so she wouldn't have seen the moss. She jumped here to here, and she slipped. After a six-hour search and rescue attempt, she did end up falling in and dying. And this shocking tragedy moved the safety officer in the park, and the safety officer is mostly focused on employee safety, but moved him to do something about it. And he actually insisted and worked with the superintendent to build this guardrail. But this, he worked painstakingly and actually made many enemies among the cultural resources folks. And it caused this tremendous friction, which when I visited them, I could sense it and see it. So this is a huge dilemma for us in injury prevention when we're dealing with this, but it was very clear in this circumstance that the people were being led to that rock. So how do you make it this guardrail so it's pretty and it meets, you know, the requirements of cultural folks and still saves lives? This is a huge dilemma, I think, that we're going to be dealing with. And I'm certain that most of you have visited our parks, and you've noted that park relies heavily on signage as a method for communicating risk. That's the main way that they can communicate things. They also provide information brochures, and one of the most effective ways that they can reach our visitors is through ranger services, providing just this direct person-to-person information to communicate risk. Unfortunately, because of shrinking resources in our parks, the visitors really don't get the benefit of this kind of contact as often as they could, and this is clearly a very effective way to reduce injury because they really can talk about reducing, drinking water, slowing down, being careful. And, you know, no matter how much we put up signs, people often don't look at signs or read signs. So, we do what we can, and even when we put up guardrails or have risks that look obvious, people don't adhere to it. What bothers me most about this picture is the 10-year-old little boy and an 8-year-old little boy watching this man. And that impresses upon a child that, okay, this is okay to do. And if this man had known that 2 weeks earlier somebody actually fell and died from that very spot, maybe he wouldn't have climbed it. But this is a, and by the way, that's about a 700-foot drop. This is a 600-foot drop where, again, in Yosemite, somebody literally a month before had slipped and fallen in just to get this picture, which is not uncommon. And this is another amazing. He's wearing sandals and had to get that picture. Why he had to get the picture, and people watching him and amazed that he actually made it over. But even the most obvious risks aren't obvious enough for some of our visitors. So our parks have to do something, and oftentimes they are very innovative. And Blue Ridge is an example. I'm going to give you a couple examples, and I might have to cut them short, but I did want to give you some. Blue Ridge Parkway had a lot of serious accidents and fatalities on the parkway. And the chief ranger said to me, we were tired of peeling bodies off the road. We couldn't take it anymore. I just couldn't go to work again and do it. So he said he would, they would begin to collect data on where the injuries are, you know, really doing epidemiology, person, place, and time. Where are they happening? When are they happening? And they did it, and they found out where they were happening. In fact, they found out one of the corners was a lot of motorcycle injuries. They didn't really realize the motorcycle injuries were occurring in this corner. So they sat down and they developed, they don't have behavioral sciences background, but they sat down and they developed this sign based on sort of discussing and seeing what influences them and put up this motorcyclist slipping. Not sure even why the motorcycles were having accidents, but amazingly, they were having several fatalities a year, and since they did that in 2002, not one fatality. Somehow that sign, now how long it will last is not clear, but in addition to signage, they did have brochures, they did have officers stopping cars randomly to talk to them about safety, to say to them, you're in a national park, did you realize that? No, I didn't realize that. Well, enjoy, have a great stay, and be careful around the corner, it's very curvy. So they pass these out, little keychains to tell people about safety, and they actually because they collected data, were able to show that they had a huge impact, and that influenced this chief ranger's whole team. I mean, these law enforcement officers are not into data collection, and they were very unhappy when he said we're going to collect data. Now these guys are so gung-ho, these big, huge officers, they're like, what else can we collect data on? This is incredible, and they are real a model for us. And then Grand Canyon has this great Hike Smart program. In addition to signage, which again is heavily relied on, they had rangers go out and talk to people about heat stroke, about drinking water. They would actually have people standing at the most key points to say, you should not hike down right now. You can't prohibit someone from doing something. But if you hike down now, the chances of your coming up are very slim. So this is and has been a very effective program where they've reduced the incidence of heat stress. This is one example, if I have time. This is a last example. I'll show Glen Canyon Recreation Area, which won the Andrew Hecht Public Safety Award from our park, which is an award that we give every year to a park that does the best public safety effort or visitor injury prevention. And what Glen Canyon did was, you may have heard of the kite tube, which is this 10-foot big fun toy that you actually fly on above a boat. A boat drags it, and it goes about 25, 35 miles an hour. And let's see, I want to tell you more specifically what happens. When there are winds that quartering winds that hit this tube, the tube can rise up uncontrollably, about 15, 25 feet. And it immediately inverts back into the air, accelerates into the water, and the combined force of the speed and the boat, plus the additional acceleration downward, was hitting victims in the water 50 miles an hour, 50 miles an hour. So all the people, the victims of this kite tube use, were using the tube as directed. They weren't doing anything wrong. There was nothing wrong with what they were doing. And the incidents that they were enduring and being victimized were internal trauma, such as coughing up blood, torn muscles, whiplash, broken ribs, punctured lungs, cervical fractures, and permanent disabilities. So if you can see this guy, he's actually flying out of this apparatus here, and will land, obviously, in the water. Glen Canyon immediately prohibited use when they found 3 or 4 deaths in a period of literally weeks. 3 or 4 serious injuries, excuse me. There was actually a fatality, but serious injuries and life-threatening. So they notified Boating Association. They notified local jurisdictions. They called the rest of the parks and said, be careful of this thing. Don't let people. They walked around the parks educating people, seeing people use it, and said, stop using it. They were so active that they actually got it removed from the market by the U.S. Product Safety Commission. So the parks can do something. They can have an impact. And so these are just some of the many examples I have. So the question now is, and I show that, what's the future direction of injury prevention? Where do we want to go? The hope for the future direction, I think, is that we do great response. We do great search and rescue. We need to do better prevention. And hopefully what we need to do is give parks support to do that, because they aren't behavioral scientists and they're not epidemiologists, so they need more tools, they need more support to do what they do. So I hope this new program will begin to capture some of these lessons learned so we can share it. Before I came here, nobody knew what other parks were doing. They were surprised, and they learned from each other. Wow, you can do that? We didn't think about that. We didn't think we could get that bold and actually get something off the market if we're active about it. I hope what we'll do is form some guidance for parks, some policy for them to begin to put things into a structural and systematic way of how they look at injury prevention. And obviously what I hope is that we have a service-wide injury collection system. So I'm working on that. It's going to be hard. It's going to be hard to get rangers to begin to provide this level of detail. They're very busy. We're strapped with resources. But hopefully I can find innovative ways to get them to provide this data and to bring it back to them so they can see how it's effective for targeting their efforts. So they don't just, someone falls in a thermal pool, they just put up a sign. Somebody slips, they put up a sign. Let's find out where it's happening, how bad is it. So I have a lot of ideas of initiatives that I'd like to do, but I want to share just a few of them. And I'd like to do better data collection and analysis of some of these injuries to scope the problem more. I'd like to conduct assessment of injury-related tort claims. We do get sued quite a bit in the parks. No one's really looked at the data to see are there patterns, are there trends, are there lessons that we can draw from those tort claims to learn about them. We don't really even know the magnitude of the cost to the federal government and to the Park Service in terms of how, the impact of tort claims. I I'm hoping to build an internship and student fellowship program to assist the program to capture best practice. I think we have tremendous opportunities for students to do fun and really interesting research. In fact, I just am setting up currently a project with a student at the Uniformed Services University of the Health Sciences, which is up here in Maryland, for him to do a study with me at George Washington Memorial Parkway, where, as you noted from the slide, they have a lot of injuries on our trails. And so that's very exciting. I think we have a tremendous opportunity. Another thing I'd like to do is build an NPS injury control network of experts. And the idea here is that I'm N equals one right now. And I really need, I don't have the level, the years of experience that many people out there have, and I need input from experts to help guide this program. And I'm trying to tap into those folks that have that expertise, that can provide guidance, that can ensure that this program has in it what it needs to be effective. Because what I'm hoping and my vision is that this program is built, and I do have a staff of 12 to 20 people who establish this program as world class. There's no reason the National Park Service should not be world class and a world expert in visitor injury in extreme environments. So I've already begun to build some partnership with CDC at the Center for Injury. We're also building relationship with our partners at DOI, Bureau of Land Management, Bureau of Reclamation, Bureau of Indian Affairs, U.S. Coast Guard, U.S. Army Corps of Engineers. I started an interagency, federal interagency on visitor safety working group. We have our first meeting in 2 weeks, and CDC will be there. So we're beginning the efforts to bring attention to this and provide support the parks need to do this. I'd like to identify and implement risk communication methods relying on web-based approaches so we get to our visitors before they get here. A lot of our visitors do use the web, and so let's find effective ways to reach them to help them plan their trip so that they're prepared. You know, the pictures I showed you of people taking these high risks and jumping, that's not the common way people get injured. It's because they're not prepared often, or they didn't know that the park would be that wild. Some people don't realize the animals are wild. And we have had people who come into the ranger station and say, there's an animal out there, it's wild. Yes, they are wild. People don't realize, this is not Disney World. And it is amazing how our visitors don't realize it's not protected. The mission of the park is not to put guardrails. And even our guardrails don't necessarily meet standards. And so when, you know, literally 2 months ago, Grand Canyon safety officer called me. Am I out of time? Oh, I'm sorry, I'm out of time. Anyway. Thank you very much.